Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
So the United States uses very little Libyan oil. Why is the price of gasoline going up here then, threatening our whole economic recovery? Let's drill down on the rising price of oil. Libya has not cut off supply, but some oil companies are slowing production there, they tell us. Saudi Arabia promises to fill in any gaps in supply, yet the price continues to climb. Two oil experts are here now to take your calls and answer these questions. Steve Levine, contributing editor to the Oil and the Glory blog at Foreign Policy Magazine, and Dan Dicker, contributor to TheStreet.com, where he writes on the energy markets, and he's the author of the forthcoming book, Oil's Endless Bid. Good morning to both of you. Welcome to WNYC.
Morning, Brian.
Good morning.
And listeners, as we head toward $5 gasoline, perhaps it's everything you wanted to know about the oil market but had no one to ask. You can call in right now, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post your question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Dan, you posted on TheStreet.com yesterday a piece called Crazy Oil Prices Driven by Perception, Not Realities. Are these prices crazy?
Well, I guess not as crazy as we saw in 2008, Brian, where they got even crazier. But what I mean by that is that they are not being moved by fundamentals. As you mentioned, you know, supply is very there's ample supply out there. There is a Saudi promise that they will take up any shortfall, and they do have 4 million barrels a day of swing barrels that they can do that with. And what you have instead is you have a price that's being driven merely by the amount of money that flows into oil as an asset class, which, in fact, you know, the oil markets, any commodity market, wasn't intended to be. It was never intended to be an investment or a bet or a wager for retail investors, for institutional investors, for any investor. And in fact, it's become that. So when you have these geopolitical things that happen, you have this flood of money that comes into a marketplace that was never designed to accept it, and you have an enormous spiking in prices like we have now.
Gosh, weren't we saying the exact same thing about our homes about 3 years ago?
Well, here's the difference about oil. You know, everybody, whether they're engaged in the market or not, is unfortunately tied to the price of energy, because everything that we do in our lives is, you know, inevitably tied to the price of energy. So if you are, you know, betting or investing on a house, or if you're betting or investing on the stock market, you know, you sort of take your risk and you take your chances. But there's a lot of people out there who don't have a bet down on oil and are getting, you know, in many ways hosed by the prices that they're seeing at the pumps. And but you're right, there is the same kind of, you know, manipulation or financialization of things that kind of skew prices, yeah.
So before we bring in Steve, who may have some other explanations, you write on your blog post that we're being taken for a ride, which makes it sound like a conspiracy. So if we're being taken for a ride, who's driving? Hedge fund speculators?
Well, here's the point. The point is that, you know, if we really want to see the villains, that a lot of them we could find by looking in the mirror. I mean, many of us are engaged, whether we know it or not, through, you know, even our pension plans, in getting an exposure into commodity markets. Now, of course, that is amplified many, many, many times by the traders in the investment banks and in the hedge funds and so forth. But the dumb money that begins to fuel that kind of speculative drive really comes from us who want to have, you know, instead of just paper assets, we want to have hard assets like commodities, including oil. And we do rush into these things, and we listen to those people who are selling these products who want to make fees off of commodity investments. So in many ways, it's a shared responsibility here. It's not just, you know, the Goldman Sachs and the Morgan Stanleys, although they do bear a tremendous responsibility in this puzzle. But we do, too.
So, Steve Levine from The Oil and the Glory, are you on board that we're being taken for a ride right now on oil prices both by hedge fund speculators, and by our own mom and pop investment strategies?
I'm not sure that I would use exactly that language. I do think that there is a quotient in the market. There's a portion of the price we're seeing right now that is due to the speculators in the market. You get a bout of uncertainty like we've seen in Libya, and then you get traders and in Europe and here in the United States piling into the market and bidding up the price. It was very interesting yesterday morning. Look at the European crude. It was bid all the way up to $119 a barrel. Then news came into the market. In the last 24 hours, the Saudis have gone around and very quietly told influential people and traders and investment bank types, hey, we've already started injecting more crude into the market. We can do this. In the last half hour of trading yesterday, the price plummeted. What did that mean? All these traders who were in the market making these bets, trying to make big money, sold their positions. They took their profits off the table. And as you've seen today, prices are not going back up. So the wild speculation that surrounded the Libya events, as far as traders, the speculators are concerned, is over.
You think it's over for good, or is it over
for a few
hours?
Let's see what happens next. But these come in chapters. So the chapter we've just seen, where oil this week, incidentally, is still up $10 a barrel. That's a lot. But the previous 2 days, it really was wild. It was a frenzy. That part is
right.
Over. The market is still concerned about what comes next. Are we going to see something in Saudi Arabia again, in Bahrain? Algeria is very important. If we do, you're going to see that same kind of frenzy return.
You blogged this week that the world changed all of a sudden with respect to that calming Saudi voice. And you also blogged that the world changed suddenly when bandits attacked a Chinese oil company operation in Libya. Do you want to tell us about either of those?
Sure. So for a number of years, really since the beginning of the 80s, Saudi Arabia has attempted to be the statesman of global oil, the reasonable voice. After all the tumult of the 70s, where its name was dragged in the mud and it was demonized. And the way that it's done this is build up its capacity to drill oil. It's by far the largest producer of oil in the world. And it's done this by building up its capacity to add volumes onto the market in an emergency like the Libyan event. It has said, Saudi Arabia has said, while Egypt has had all this trouble, while Libya is going up in flames and Tunisia and Bahrain, we're going to have no unrest. Then, 2 days ago, King Abdullah came home after 3 months being away for medical treatment. The first thing he did was announced, I'm going to give my people $36 billion, wage increases, debt forgiveness. The way the market saw this was, hey, wait a second, if you guys are so stable, why is the king buying off his people? I think that really affected, that's changed mm-hmm. perceptions. The second thing that happened, and I'll make this shorter, is that the presumption has been through all of this unrest of the last several weeks that the oil installations, there can be looting, streets on fire, buildings blow up. No one has done anything in any of these countries to sabotage, to stop the oil flow. In Libya, however, we had bandits attack a Chinese oil installation, CNPC, and the Chinese evacuated dozens of their people in the country. So that has told the market that, hey, the more the unrest goes on, the oil installations in all of these all these countries, wherever they're located, are vulnerable.
Dan, real concerns?
Well, look, you know, the thread that has gone through Algeria, Tunisia, and Egypt, and Yemen, and Bahrain has been poverty And while I wouldn't classify all of these protests as being economic, I also wouldn't classify them as being purely political. And so it was very clear that when we talk about a real supply disruption, we are talking about Saudi Arabia, and that's been what's been on the table for the traders for the last couple of days. It has had very little to do with Libyan output. It has had more to do with how the contagion might or might not spread to Saudi Arabia. So, my thesis is that it doesn't get there. I could be wrong, but my thesis doesn't get there for precisely, the reason that your other guest has mentioned. They have a lot of money. They don't have the poverty problems for the people that these other countries do. So for the Saudi sheiks to come back and put $35 billion on the table, that's, an obvious move to quell some of the possible problems that they might have in Saudi Arabia. Past that, we've had a generalized oil move from $68 since the BP Gulf oil disaster to, a basis price of about $110 today. Now, that is clearly not all about Libya, nor is it about Egypt, nor is it about peak oil. What it's about, another $80 billion going into commodity index funds, another $100 billion going into commodity ETFs, and following, in fact, the trajectory of other asset classes like the stock market and high-yield bonds, and being fueled by a low cost for money, QE2 and 3, and all these things are interconnected. To take oil out of that picture is wrong. It's a process that gets hyped in certain times when the geopolitical event makes it even more exciting. But for the most part, we've had a steady march of climbing oil prices, and I think we will continue to see them even if things calm down in the Middle East.
Richard in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to give a little history for younger listeners. I worked for Aramco, Arabian American Oil Company, back in the 70s, and we had the oil embargo. And I know, because I did the books, that we had like a 9-month supply of gas and oil, Bahrain, pipelines, tankers, et cetera. And yet the gasoline disappeared overnight until the prices doubled, and then suddenly the gas became available. A little suspicious of what's going on, but I think your guest rightly pointed out that I think the recently deified Ronald Reagan was responsible for allowing speculators to control the price of oil. I'd just like to listen to your comments.
Thank you. Who wants that?
Well, actually, the Commodity Modernization Act is, actually, if you're going to pin it on somebody, I think you have to pin it on, unfortunately, Bill Clinton. That was 2000.
And Steve?
Yeah, no, I'll just leave it there. That's a very, very interesting comment. Yeah.
Frank in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Frank.
Hi. Why do the feds subsidize big oil for about $100 billion a year by some estimates, and not to mention the cost of protecting oil militarily? It just seems to me like that as a mature industry, it no longer needs government subsidies, and that we could help improve the budget picture there.
Thank you, Frank. It's a great question. Stephen, this came up during the State of the Union address, where President Obama suggested ending subsidies from federal taxpayers to the oil industry and moving those subsidies over to research on renewables. But how much do we subsidize the oil industry? And at this point in a mature industry, how come?
This topic, it ends up being a visceral one for the very reasons that the caller stated. The trouble is that when you dig down, you can do this absolute number where you add up everything in everyone's pie. But again, when you dig down into it, it's a lot less clear than the way that it's not like ExxonMobil is receiving $25 billion a year in a tax write-off for its drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. It's not like that. So I think that the oil industry, for all of the things people say about it, it's an absolutely strategic industry. There are parts of it that are subsidized, that perhaps you can cut some of it out. But again, it's not as cut and dried as President Obama stated it, nor than as the caller stated it.
Dan, do you differ at all?
Well, the only thing that I would say is that, and the caller makes a good point, and I don't know why they continue to deal subsidies to oil companies. It's a longstanding tradition. The lobbies are very, very strong. The thing that I would take issue with is that we are, in fact, sitting on what is a domestic, clean, plentiful, and cheap energy supply that would allow us to not send another, $250 billion a year to foreign countries that don't particularly like us very much. That's natural gas. And I've been amazed, as a lot of people in the industry have been amazed, that the White House has not gotten behind this fuel, which I think they inevitably have to. And in fact, that is as well an infrastructure issue. So it will require certain amount of government involvement to move that agenda along. But I'm hoping that at some point, or maybe this oil spike, will start to move that process forward.
Does that involve the hydrofracking that we keep talking about here in New York?
Yeah, it does. And in many ways, it's gotten a very, very bad rap in my view, and in some cases, correctly so, but in most cases, not correctly so. And a lot of the hype surrounding hydraulic fracturing, particularly by this documentary Gasland that's been running around, is a little more than propaganda. Now, we can argue that the gas organizations also have their own brand of propaganda that they like to push around there. And on balance, reasonable people, have to take a look at the issues that are really surrounding this. But I would have hoped that, the BP spill over the summer last year would convince people of the environmental risks about procuring oil wherever it is, whether it's in our backyard or whether it's 150 miles offshore.
And by the way, speaking of Gasland, which is one of the best documentary Oscar nominees for this Sunday night, we'll be talking about it again in about 20 minutes when we ask, what makes a best documentary? Is it how good the movie or how good the cause? Coming up in about 20 minutes. We're just about out of time for you two, but just let me ask you one thing real quick. Steve, there was a WikiLeaks mention of Saudi Arabia not having the oil reserves that they claim, and I think that may have been debunked, but are you familiar with that and its veracity?
Sure. Yeah, well, I blogged on this about a week ago. Look, this is the fault of the Saudis themselves. The Saudis have not been transparent in demonstrating that they do have the volumes, the reserves that they say they do, and so they ought to, allow an outside auditor to come in and check their reserves. In addition, that has been the trouble in the volatility of the market over the last 2 weeks. Again, the lack of Saudi transparency. Do I have a second to add one more thing?
Go ahead real quick.
Okay, just on the natural gas thing, I think that the United States does need to get really big into the natural gas, but the industry itself has hobbled the situation by not pushing this itself.
And there we leave it with Steve Levine, contributing editor to the Oil and the Glory blog at Foreign Policy Magazine, Dan Dicker, contributor to thestreet.com, where he writes on the energy markets, and he's the author of the forthcoming book, Oil's Endless Bid. And the sort of good news this morning is that oil prices seem to, for the moment at least, have stabilized around where they peaked to this week, as the Saudis are raising oil output in response to fears about Libya. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.